I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. High-octane thrills, open roads, freedom. You may not be able to try these stunts at home, but you can certainly watch them there. Today, the DVD gurus are back to talk cinema's love affair with the car. In Ronin, Robert De Niro plays a freelancing former U.S. intelligence agent who is trying to find a mysterious package wanted by the Irish and the Russians. Ryan Gosling is a mysterious Hollywood stuntman, mechanic, and getaway driver who lands himself in trouble in the movie Drive. Mad Max takes us to the futuristic Australia, where a vicious biker gang murders a cop's family. We're talking these films and more, the DVD gurus, on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the love affair between the movies and the automobile dates back almost to the beginning of American cinema. Today, Mitch and Jason are here to document this long-standing relationship with a set of films that scream open roads, freedom, and high-octane thrills. We'll be talking about Mad Max, The Driver, American Graffiti, Ronin, and several others. The DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter and UMKC film professor who writes for 435 South Magazine. Mitch, always good to have you here.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Yes. Jason is Jason Heck, film critic for Inc. Magazine at the Kansas City Star. Jason, how are you?
As the owner of a 78 Chevy Vega, I can't start my engine. My car is actually built out of compressed rust, but I'm doing my
brother.
Best.
Now, you all were talking before this show. There's actually, did not know this, an internet movie database for cars and films.
Yeah, imcdb.org, Internet Movie Cars Database. Like the Internet Movie Database, it is maintained by what we can lovably term geeks.
I was going to say,
incredible car and movie aficionados. Well, it's kind of fascinating because if there's a movie out there, like I did Death Race for the show a few months ago, you remember it. All those cars in the movie were all these heavily modified cars. Well, the guys at IMCDB knew exactly what year, you know, Buick Boattail Riviera circa 1966, and they tell you who modified them. They talk to the guys who did the modifications, all the Hollywood agencies and firms who remanufacture these cars, the stunt teams. These people will actually talk to them and find out, you know, how many cars were built, how many were destroyed. It's actually a pretty fascinating resource. That's IMCDB.org.
I did not know. Have you looked at this website before, Mitch Brown?
I only looked at it today. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about it. And the one that I think is amazing is the
IMFDB.org.
IMFDB. That's the Internet Movie Firearms Database that tells you every gun used in every movie. So, yeah, you know, there's
– people want to know.
People want to know.
Yeah, just as fascinating. I mean, if you want to know exactly what kind of Colt single action army John Wayne was toting in Rio Bravo, it'll tell you that it's the cavalry model or the artillery model or whatever. These guys know their stuff. And again, they talk to the armorers, the Hollywood guys who equip the various actors and actresses, and it's a small community, and it's if you like this kind of stuff, if you are a geek, I am a geek. So I spend some time at these websites, but mostly at the IMCDB to do my research for the show today. Mitch, of course, not a researcher, didn't do any of it. And that's fine. Mitch is mostly about opinion. I'm about fact.
It just makes you wonder. I mean, is there anything on the planet you can't find on the internet anymore? This is amazing to me. Well, Mitch Bryan, why do cars and movies go so well together here, which is the theme of today's program?
I guess it's all about motion. It's all about movement, you know. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the movie camera was invented, which was, you know, not that long after the time of the automobile.
Right.
In fact, at the height of the studio system, Hollywood actually looked to Detroit, looked to the manufacturing of automobiles, the assembly line mentality, and the great days of the studio system sort of used that same assembly line mentality when they were making movies. You know, every person had a specific job that contributed to the overall product. But I think with the automobile and the motion picture, the minute somebody could figure out how to rig a camera to a car, they did, because mm-hmm. it allowed you to cover the action. And we see those great westerns with cavalry charges. You know, there's somebody on a truck with a camera driving alongside of them. So they are, you know, movies are a technological form anyway. So they are linked, you know, inexorably with the automobile.
Americans love movies. Americans love cars. Right?
Yeah. And then after World War II, you know, that we saw this blooming of the automobile culture. You know, we saw both because of the suburban sprawl and also, I think, you know, just generally because people came back to America and this was at the point of our sort of most affluent period, and everybody had a car, and people could drive across the country, and Jack Kerouac writes On the Road, and California sort of really emerges as this major sort of automobile culture, especially with the Los Angeles freeway system.
Mm-hmm.
It all sort of comes together. You know?
Well, are cool cars still as much a part of the movies as they used to be, Jason, or is that sort of faded as gas has gone from three, sort of narrowing up close to $4 a gallon?
You would get paper cuts counting all the money the Fast and the Furious franchise has made. You know, it's a different kind of car culture right now. It may be all about, you know, less about muscle cars, more about, you know, customizing and tricking out, you know, various Asian makes and models. But it's still a huge part of our culture. It's, you know, gas here is cheaper than anywhere on the face of the earth. You know, mm-hmm. Europeans pay the equivalent of $7 a gallon. And, you know, for us, gas is dirt cheap. Our country is vast and connected by this enormous interstate highway system that went up right after World War II. You know, I think Mitch is right. It sort of started – the first car to hit the showroom after all the factories were sort of retooling after World War II was actually a Kaiser. Henry J. Kaiser, the shipping magnate, manufactured these huge cars, and that was the first one to hit the showroom in 46. And you look at it and you think, boy, this isn't really great. But then you look, it's a photo in life, and people are gathered around, thousands of people looking at this brand new car. And, you know, it was a country that had literally worked its way out of the Depression with wartime manufacturing. Everybody was working. That includes women. That includes blacks who were working in, who had been brought in to work in northern factories. So a lot of people were making a lot of money. And since public transportation was still big, but we were putting in the interstates, everybody needed a car. And it wasn't really – it didn't take too long until people started making their car match their own personality and lifestyle.
Well, when I think of cars in movies, I tend to think of car chases. And when I think of car chases in the movies, the greatest car chase of them all, I still think – I just saw it on TV not long ago, Steve McQueen in –
In Bullet.
Bullet.
Yeah.
What a car chase. San Francisco, just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah,
even
that's
today,
the thing that probably
after
makes
all
it
these years,
better
yeah.
than the one in the French Connection, which I also think is an extraordinary car chase. But those hills in San Francisco are just amazing.
Yeah, that chase goes on and on and on and on. And it's, you know, I've read about that chase. They had all the problems they had and everything else. But what an amazing, amazing documentary that is.
Yeah.
It was all driven by McQueen and a stuntman named Bill Hickman, who also did the driving in The French Connection. And in a movie called The Seven Ups, he was sort of this really great stunt driving pro. And in the movie, of course, he's sort of this crew-cutted kind of Coke bottle-glassed hitman who's driving the Charger. But, you know, the minute he pulls on those black leather gloves and buckles his seatbelt, that the chase is about to kick into seriously high gear.
Is Bullet the best car chase ever filmed?
No, it's the most iconic car chase ever filmed. But there are chases that, you know, honestly, it's rich and rare to get a really good non-CGI'd car chase anymore. Non-CGI'd, a car chase that doesn't rely on a lot of digital effects and stuff. You know, Terminator 2 had a great one in, you know, the sewer sort of thing with the truck chasing the dirt bike. I thought that was great. You know, and then Ronin, honestly, which I'm going to be talking about, is extraordinary in the amount of skill. I mean, in one scene, there are 300 stunt drivers. To Live and Die in L.A. has an amazing one. That was done by William Friedkin, who also did French Connection. I think the French Connection is certainly the most famous, or Bullet is certainly the most famous, because McQueen did a lot of his own driving, and the cars are so iconic and the location so iconic. But I don't think it's the best one.
Well, speaking of Steve McQueen, Bob from Weston writes us this: the best car movie ever, he writes, Le Mans, starring Steve McQueen. It was realistic wheel-to-wheel racing scenes with real cars and real race drivers, depicting the early 70s era of Porsche versus Ferrari at the 24 Hours of Le Mans in France. This is even a storyline to act. There's even a storyline to the action, 24 hours around the clock, all weather conditions, and the end over 3,000 miles of racing. Wow.
Completely great pick, Mitch. And I contemplated it. It's the fact that Le Mans is so race intensive and so documentary in its feel. There isn't actually a lot of dialogue in it. And Mitch and I pull clips for dialogue that last at least 60 to 90 seconds for every movie. There wasn't really a compelling win in Le Mans, but it's a great pick. I agree. Absolutely.
And an extraordinary score, too.
Yeah.
He also writes this, in that era, there were even photo finishes, the recreated racing scenes cut among true live action shots from the actual race were done with such accuracy they even smashed bugs in the cars for the 180 mile per hour. Per hour effect.
Yeah, and McQueen, of course, did a lot of his own driving. You know, you put him in the wheel. I don't know what he raced. I think it was maybe a Porsche 917. I'm not sure if he was in the Porsche or the Ferrari, but he did all his own driving. And you know, he was a man who constantly challenged himself on dirt bikes, on motorcycles, and behind the wheel with endurance and skill and speed. And it was just another way for him to find his limits.
Well, you see him handling the motorcycle pretty well in the Great Escape film too.
Another stuntman named Bud Elkins, I think, did most of the bike
over the fence.
McQueen did a lot of his riding, but sometimes well, when it's the man or the legend, print the legend. And so I think he was justly famed for a lot of what he did, but he did not do all of his driving in Bullet or in The Great Escape.
Well, Mitch and Jason are here. We're talking about the best car movies ever made. If you want to join our conversation with a pick, you're welcome to do so. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Email UpToDate at KCUR.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Well, Jason Heck, you're up first with a film that a lot of folks are familiar with, Mad Max.
Yeah, the real harbinger of the Australian filmmaking movement that broke upon our shores in the late 70s and early 80s. This one has remained among the biggest and certainly the most iconic. Mad Max, it launched Mel Gibson onto our shores, for better or for worse, depending on how you feel about his filmmaking and his personal life. The story is also really got a post-apocalyptic kind of thing on our minds. Its sequel, Mad Max 2, billed in this country as Mad Max 2 Electric Boogaloo, also known as The Road Warrior, did so with much more finesse, much more panache, and certainly a much bigger budget. But I like this one. I like the low-budget feel. Basically, it's Australia, sort of a few years from now, as they tell us. It's a post-apocalyptic kind of scene, but there are pockets of civilization, and these are connected and maintained by the highway system and the MFP, which is the Main Force Patrol. And the MFP has sort of two kinds of cars. They have pursuit and interceptors, and the interceptor, the best one, is Max Rockatansky, Mel Gibson. And he is sort of the best guy, and you know, the pursuit guys chase the bad guys and the interceptors hang out ahead of them and play chicken with them and run them off the road. And he is the best one. Well, he picks a fight with the wrong gang. He kills a gang member called the Knight Rider, and the Knight Rider's compatriots, led by the Toe Cutter. It's an old fraternity nickname, I'm sure. a motorcycle gang sort of run roughshod over this town, and they pick a fight with Max and his family. Max's family meets a tragic end. Max becomes mad and goes bananas. It was a no-budget kind of movie. It was made by a director named George Kennedy and a producer named George Miller and a producer named Byron Kennedy, who met in 1971. Miller was a doctor at the time, and they made a sort of a low-budget film called, I believe, A History of Violence in Cinema that made sort of toured a few film festivals. They took 8 years to find money to do this, and they made this really great police movie, Western movie, post-apocalyptic movie, but most of all, action movie. And it was really, it split critics. Some of them said, you know, this is great. The sadists and the budding Charles Mansons will love this movie. But some people recognized, hey, there's a lot of craftsmanship here. This isn't exploitation of the normal sort. This is a real movie made by guys with a real vision. The cars, I want to talk about the cars in each movie. These were all made by Ford Australia, which is a division of Ford that doesn't bring any cars over here. So the interceptors and the pursuit vehicles, known as the Big Bopper and the March Hare, were Ford Falcon XB sedans, 1974s. The most iconic car from the film is Max's Black Pursuit Special, also known as the V8 Interceptor. This car is honestly as cool as a car can be. And it is a GT351 1973 Ford XB Falcon hardtop. And it has a monster blower, an air-driven, mechanically driven supercharger jutting out of the hood. It can put 600 horsepower to the wheels. And Max uses it to completely eliminate something like a dozen bikers after his wife and child meet a tragic end. It is incredibly kinetic. It is a movie that is very exciting. Gibson gives a pretty good performance, actually. I'm a big fan of Hugh, an actor named Hugh Keyes Byrne, who plays the toe cutter as this completely bananas, goofy nihilist. I like the movie quite a bit. Now, I will say that The Road Warrior is a better film. The Road Warrior is a top-notch, top 10, top-tier action movie. It's an incredible movie. But Mad Max has sort of this kitchen sink feel to it that I appreciate and like quite a bit.
What's the clip we got here, Doc?
Well, this is a great clip. This is actually Max's friend Goose, his buddy on the force, and a mechanic named Barry are introducing Max to the last V8 ever made, the Interceptor, the Pursuit Special.
From Mad Max.
Kick it in the guts, Barry. Shut the gate on this one, Max. Here, it's the duck's guts.
Yeah, she's the last of the V8. She sucks nitro. Face forehead. Twin overhead.
Cut about the blower, yeah?
600 horsepower through the wheel. With the blower.
With the blower.
Oh, she's meanness, but the music. And the bitch is born to life.
He's in a coma, man.
Loves it.
How the hell did you get all this together?
It just happened, Max. You know, piece from here and a piece from there.
So easy?
Yeah.
Come on, Max. You've seen it. You've heard it. And you're still asking questions.
When do we go for a ride?
They sound like us.
But it won't be a joyride. It'll be a ride of death and destruction and mayhem for the Knight Riders gang.
And that engine, holy moly.
It's pretty great. When you see the blower, the big belt on the blower churning, all you think of is this thing could tow the battleship Missouri. It's really great.
We're talking cars and movies with Mitch and Jason. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. We're looking for some great picks from our listeners. Ben from Joyce from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to let you know that Steve McQueen, as a child, lived in Slater, Missouri.
Did not know that.
It is a small town in Saline County in the middle of the state, and every spring they have a Steve McQueen festival. And it's usually in April, and his wife comes some of the years, and some of the men who were stuntmen with him also come, and they have different displays, and they play his movies in the gym at the school, and it's just a fun day, and people bring their cars, and there's a car show along with it, and it's really a fun thing. And I don't have the website offhand, but if you look up Slater, Missouri, why, there will be a calendar of events there that shows when it is.
Well, that Joyce, I'm glad you called. That would be a great conversation to have some of those folks in here. Were you aware that there's a Slater, Missouri Steve McQueen Festival?
No, I wasn't. Yeah. That sounds really, really fun, though. And if it's in April, I think I'd love to visit.
It's a great event. So, you know, Slater would be glad to have you there anytime.
Well, Joyce, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ben from Prairie Village. Ben, you're on up today. Good morning.
Good morning. I was listening to you. You guys mentioned French Connection and Bullet. One other movie that I enjoyed was Bourne Ultimatum.
For the car chase?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't remember the car chase there. Was there a great car chase there?
Well, the minis were in the first one. I don't remember
Bourne
Ultimatum.
This one was in New York City when the CIA guys were chasing him, trying to kill him.
Oh, I do remember that now.
The CIA really takes it on the chin in the Bourne movies, doesn't it?
That's a good one, Ben. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Brent emails us at updatedatkcur.org. There are two classic car chases in the Blues Brothers, one through the mall and then the other at the end through Lower Wacker Drive.
That's right, the famous Dixie Square Mall sequence. And, for a while it hung in the Guinness Book as the most car crashes ever in a movie, most stunt drivers ever used in a movie, most indulgent director ever used in a movie with John Landis, Give Me More, More, More.
Well, Mary Lee from Baldwin City, Kansas, and Mike also write us, don't forget the Blues Brothers, Mary Lee writes, that movie gets my vote for best car chase ever, as I like some absurdity with my wild driving. And if the pack of police cars, cowboy rednecks, jilted fiance, and everyone else chasing Jake and Elwood, don't take it over the top, the movie has the most killer soundtrack ever.
Agreed. And there's nothing like seeing Tucker McElroy and the good old boys in their Winnebago take that leap into the lake. Absolutely. Great movie.
Yeah. Mike, who wrote us about Smokey and the Bandit, as well as the Blues Brothers, also writes, I'm a native of San Francisco. When I got my first car, I wanted to do the bullet run in my mom's station wagon. I am sad to report that the course taken in the film just doesn't line up. It's edited so well that it works on screen, but it has them driving all over the city from the north part of town in one turn to the southern edges, focusing very little on the neighborhood most iconically featured.
It's true, but, you know, you should have just taken that station wagon down Lombard Street at about 40 miles an hour.
Nothing like having Mom's Country Squire.
Stella from Overland Park writes, Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof has one of the best car chases ever, harkening back to classic chases with no digital additions. The Dodge Challenger looks just amazing, she writes.
I will be talking about that very film the second half of the show.
So okay. Buckle your seatbelts.
Yes. Bill from Lawrence, you're on up today. Bill, good morning.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. A cult movie from my youth that doesn't involve a great deal of car chases, but a hideous amount of methamphetamines, Mopar V8s, and bulldozers is Vanishing Point.
I was watching it last night. Yeah, it's a really terrific movie.
Still, yeah,
I think it still kind of holds up. It's a time capsule now. It's different, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely. I'm glad somebody put in a cheer for the Wacker Drive thing in Blues Brothers.
That's right. Driving right through City Hall.
Yeah. Steve Kratzky.
Yes, Bill.
You do great interviews. You do the heavy ones and you do the light ones, but you do a great job.
Hey, thanks for the nice words, Bill. I sure appreciate it.
Appreciate your work.
Have a great weekend. Yeah. Mitch Bryan, but before we get to a break here, how about a movie appropriately named Drive?
Drive was the best movie of 2011, honestly. It was the best movie last year. You won't be hearing about it on Oscar night. It's a terrific film directed by a Danish director, Nicholas Winding Refn. Who had made prior to that a terrific Viking gladiator movie called Valhalla Rising, and prior to that a movie called Bronson about the notorious English prisoner. But Drive stars Ryan Gosling as a Hollywood stunt driver by day and a getaway driver at night, and it's a film that is so extraordinary, so beautiful.
Really?
You just fall into it. It's hypnotic. It's sort of an homage to 80s films. It's a Los Angeles movie, deals with, you know, streets and miles, the hundred mile city of Los Angeles at night. It's just an amazing film. He plays this driver who gets in over his head. He falls in love with a woman whose husband is involved with some criminals, decides that he's going to do the right thing and help her husband out, and gets himself into a really terrible mess. Because prior to that, he was the guy who says, you've got me for 5 minutes, but any minute before or after that, I have nothing to do with you. And he's this hardened professional in that sort of Steve McQueen mold who cares a little bit too much and steps out of that comfort zone. And hell follows with him. I mean, it really is an extraordinary movie. It was made in Europe. I mean, it was financed with European money. It had already made $70 million or something like that by the time it got here. And it seemed as if the distributors here weren't necessarily interested in the picture. And when they did try to sell it on TV, they sold it as this sort of high-octane chase movie. And it's sort of misleading, because where Drive really lives is in the quiet moments between the chase scenes.
Hmm.
And it has shocking violence that erupts into the picture halfway through, which really sort of threw people off. In fact, there's a woman who's bringing some kind of squirrely lawsuit against the producers because she thought she was going to see The Fast and the Furious, and she says she's been emotionally traumatized by the picture.
How rough is it?
It's pretty rough.
Okay.
It's pretty rough. It's an R-rated movie. It's a movie for grown-ups.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Mitch and I believe saw it together at a screening that I did for Inc. Magazine, and we both came out of it really, really floored. I think it is. You know,
I didn't hear much about it. It's
amazing. Antithesis of this movie. The one thing that, I think really throws people off in it more than the violence is these incredibly long takes. Now, they're not long for normal movies, but since 1997, when Michael Bay gave us the no shot longer than 7 seconds, you know, that he's giving these loving, lingering close-ups of 30 seconds or more, because Gosling's character doesn't have a lot of lines. So if he's going to develop, he's going to have to act. And how is he going to act? By letting the camera linger on him and letting him use his eyes, letting him use his face, and all these other tricks that actors have kind of forgotten about now because they don't get long enough to do it. It is absolutely – it is very sensual, the movie,
too. I think some of my talent on the radio gets lost because I'm so good with my face, and the listeners just don't pick up on a lot of that.
What's weird is how weak I feel in the knees when you and I make good eye contact here across the desk.
What's the clip we got here, Dr.
This
Ryan?
Is a wonderful turn by Albert Brooks, the comedian who plays a mobster in the film, and this is his initial introduction to the driver, filling him in about his partner who didn't do so well lately.
From Drive.
Did Shannon ever tell you how we met? I used to produce movies in the 80s, kind of like action films, sexy stuff. One critic called them European. I thought they were shit. Anyway, he arranged all the cars for me, did all the stunts. I liked them. I liked having him around. Even though he overcharged the shit out of me. His next business venture, he got involved with some of Nino's friends. They didn't go for the overcharging bit. They broke his pelvis. He's never had a lot of luck. The reason I'm telling you this is that he has a lot invested in you. And so do I. So anything you need, you call me. We're a team now. I'm excited.
That's from Drive. Lots of email here about great car films. Stephen writes about The Wrath. Charlie Sheen, great car.
The Wraith.
Wraith, sorry.
He's heaven sent and hell on wheels.
Okay. Yep. Gabby in Independence writes, I'm old enough to remember the car chasing Grease. Saw it in its first release at the movies. John Travolta driving Grease Lightning to victory will always be part of my teens. Kurt emails, let's not forget Grand Prix. Great actors and great footage. Also, Two-Lane Blacktop and Crazy Mary Dirty Larry.
Grand Prix actually directed by John Frankenheimer, who directed Ronin, which we're going to be talking about in the second half of the show. But yeah, James Garner, sort of think Le Mans, but a little talkier and a little bit more acting.
And Jeff writes, hey guys, what about Death Race 2000 and Cannibal, a fun Corman Bartel 70s car films?
I don't love Death Race. I don't think it's aged really, Death Race 2000. I don't think it's aged really well, but it certainly has a lot of fun with its subject matter. And Cannonball, I haven't seen in forever and a day.
What's this music from?
This is from Drive.
From Drive. Okay. Well, coming up in our second half, we'll go to Ronin, American Graffiti, Death Proof, and The Driver. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're talking cars and great films today. If you missed yesterday's conversation about becoming American in Missouri with attorney and author Alex George, you'll find it and our weekend to-do list at kcur.org. Monday on the program, thinking about hiring a new employee, make sure you do a background check. We'll examine that and some other job-searching tips from the Star's Diane Stafford. That's Monday on the program. What film is this music from?
This is from Mad Max.
Mad Max, okay. Jason Heck, you're up next with the film Ronin.
Ronin, Masterless Ronin. Samurai. Yeah, Ronin is a really interesting movie. It's John Frankenheimer did it, and John Frankenheimer has directed some extraordinarily good films in his life. He's directed The Main Train Candidate, he directed Seconds, did 7 Days in May. He's also directed a few lumps. He did also directed Prophecy. Which has the best mutated bear killing a boy in a sleeping bag sequence you've ever seen in your life. It's just amazing. It hits the kid like a ping pong ball. You'd love it. Ronin is a look into the world of mercenaries, but unlike mercenaries in the Dogs of War, these are sort of guns for hire, like sort of urban criminal types. You've got a professional driver, you've got a weapons man, you've got a KGB computer guy, and they are all assembled by a very beautiful and mysterious Irish woman, played by Natasha McElhone, to go after a silver case. They have this silver, large silver case, looks like a big, heavy, large metallic briefcase sort of thing that is being transported by some men, and their job is to get it. And that's really the plot. That's the plot for the first two-thirds of the movie until it kind of goes off the rails a little bit in the last third and gets a little bit not great.
Hmm.
But the movie stars Robert De Niro as Sam, who is our sort of American mercenary protagonist, claims to be ex-CIA. We've got a really good supporting cast. Jean Reno plays Vincent, the French scrounger who can find any item in Paris that they need for equipment. You've got Jonathan Pryce, Stellan Skarsgård, Sean Bean, who makes every movie a half star better. unfortunately, in this one, he sort of is kind of a poseur with a tender tummy. But the movie is anchored by multiple spectacular car chases. And that is why it has become this sort of favorite of European car aficionados. It starts off with a very small kind of getaway chase in Paris, but in the middle, you have a huge set piece where they actually take the case from three cars in transit, a convoy, and they have to bushwhack it. And this takes place in Nice on the Riviera with cars racing through streets with maybe a foot of clearance on either side. These are small European streets.
Wow.
And they are doing obscene speeds through these very tiny streets and crashing through, you know, fish markets and everything
else. Fish markets always get nailed in these
movies.
Fruit stands. Actually, bit of trivia. Famous male porn star Ron Jeremy does have a role in the film as a fishmonger, but it ended up on the cutting room floor. No lie. He appeared under his real name, Ron Hyatt. I don't know how he ended up in the movie, but
probably don't want to know.
Test audiences cracked up, and when they saw him, I guess, in his beret, and, oh, no, my fish. So that ended up on the cutting room floor. Notable cars in the movie? Well, the most famous one is the Audi S8, which Larry, who is the professional driver, he says, I need a car that can shovel a bit and handle the nitrous system. Vincent steals him an Audi S8 Quattro, so it's all-wheel drive. It was portrayed as stolen to order and fitted with nitrous, and it's chosen for its bulk, grip, and torque. So it's got all-wheel drive and can corner like nothing else. There's also the famous chase at the end of the movie, which is a BMW M5 being pursued by a Peugeot 406. Couple of really interesting things about the car chases. The actors were on the left side with fake steering wheels. The cars were all right-hand drive British cars. So Frankenheimer would put his camera in there aiming at the real actors while they were doing incredible speeds with stunt drivers who were not visible. And so when you see De Niro looking completely focused and terrified while he's driving, Robert De Niro was completely focused and terrified because he was being driven at 120 miles an hour by a stuntman through some city street.
Oh, my God.
Frankenheimer also had no second unit director. He decided to shoot all the action stuff himself. He was occasionally riding along in the cars himself. And, you know, the guy shot Grand Prix. He knows how to do stuff like this. And the movie it is car chase heaven. All the sound people rode along. They recorded the actual sounds of the cars during the chases so they could match them up perfectly and not have sort of phony sounding sounds matched up afterward. It's beautiful.
Well, why would Robert De Niro risk it like that?
Robert De Niro risks it always to, you know, this is the guy who hung out with surgeons for multiple hours to see how they organize their tools so he could organize his tool bag that way when he played a rogue heating engineer in the movie Brazil. This is a guy who is famous for putting stuff on the line for. Now, at 98, you know, he had sort of started to phone in a few things in 98.
Yeah.
But I think he had an idea of how good and how real it would look, and it does. It looks like he's really doing all of this driving.
What's the clip here we have, Jason?
This clip, lamentably, there wasn't a lot of dialogue to pull during the chase scenes because it was always, you know, left and break and things like that. So what we have here is kind of a nice scene. We have Jean-Pierre, who is a French kind of ex-spy who has sort of nursed De Niro back to health after he got shot. And De Niro, he's telling Robert De Niro the story, or Sam, the story of the 47 Ronin, which is obviously where our movie gets its title. So we kind of learn about how this ancient masterless samurai group relates to the modern mercenaries.
Okay, from Ronin.
47 samurai whose master was betrayed and killed by another lord. They became ronin, masterless samurai, disgraced by another man's treachery. And for 3 years they plotted, pretending to be thieves, mercenaries, even madmen that I didn't have time to do. And then one night they struck, slipping into the castle of their lord's betrayer, killing him.
Nice. Like that. My kind of job.
There's something more. All 47 of them committed seppuku, ritual suicide, in the courtyard of the castle.
Well, that I don't like so much.
But you understand it.
What do you mean I understand it?
The warrior code. The delight in the battle, you understand that, yes? But also something more. You understand there is something outside yourself that has to be served. And when that need is gone, when belief has died, what are you? A man without a master.
Right now I'm a man without a paycheck.
The Ronin could have hired themselves to new masters. They could have fought for themselves. But they chose honor. They chose myth.
They chose wrong.
That's from Ronin. We're talking about great car films with Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, our DVD gurus. Our number again, 816-235-2888. Kevin from Prairie Village, good morning.
Yeah, hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I was wondering if you guys had seen a film short made by the French director Claude Lelouch. I think that's how his name's pronounced. He made a movie in the late 70s called Rendezvous. It's a 10-minute film. He had film left over from making a feature-length movie. And on a Sunday morning in August, he strapped a camera to the left front fender of a Ferrari 275 GTB. And right at dawn, went ripping through Paris in a straight cut, no interruptions, and staged a couple of people to warn him on certain intersections. But I think he broke about 100 traffic laws filming it. And the sound and the near misses are unbelievable. Mm. And a lot of car guys know about this. I've seen it in a number of car club meetings. So I wonder if either of you guys had ever seen it or heard of it.
Interesting.
No, but where can we see it? Is it a DVD extra anywhere?
It's a DVD you could get. It's been released again on DVD, and it's at www.spiritlevelfilm.com how I got hold of it.
And what's the title again?
It's called Rendezvous.
Cool.
A film by Claude Lelouch.
Lelouch, yeah.
Yeah, Lelouch, who I think still active as a film director.
Yeah, he made Another Man and Another Woman, or Man and a Woman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's an unbelievable film, and the sound is just terrific. And he deliberately chose a Sunday morning in August in Paris because a lot of people in Paris are out of the city at that time of year.
Yeah.
And it's really something to see, just for the sound and how he did it with no interruptions.
Well, great recommendation, Kevin. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
Mitch Bryan, tell us about a classic, American Graffiti, with my buddy Ronnie Howard.
A classic indeed.
Opie.
Opie with a full head of hair.
Yes,
still,
that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, 1973, this was George Lucas's breakout movie. I mean, it was a movie that was made for, you know, $770,000, something like that, and ultimately has grossed over $200 million in its lifetime. And
wow.
It was, of course, the movie that put him on the map, and ultimately he would follow up with a little number called Star Wars that would do all right as well. But I think the interesting thing about American Graffiti, and maybe it's because he was coming out of having just made this movie, THX-1138, which is a science fiction film, very formalist designed movie. You get to American Graffiti and you see somebody who is still firmly interested in the aesthetics of movie making. The compositions are almost science fiction-like in places, with these beautiful cars and this circular drive-in, if you remember the drive-in that they all hung out at. And it has this kind of fetishistic sort of car love all over it. I mean, it almost every single scene, with the exception of the scenes at the hop – every single scene involves a car. Either somebody's in a car, somebody's getting out of a car, somebody's fixing a car, somebody's racing a car, and it is completely – or talking about a car. It is completely consumed with the notion of the automobile and the car culture, which Lucas himself sort of grew up in as a young man in high school. I guess he was something of a gearhead. And so what you have is this coming-of-age story with – you've got on one hand Ron Howard, on the other hand Richard Dreyfuss, both of them planning to go off – to college the next morning. The entire movie takes place in the space of about, you know, 8 hours, one night, their last night in town. All the people that they encounter, the new friends saying goodbye to old friends, and then it's kind of anchored by this character, John Milner, who is this hot rod driver who drives around in a 32 Ford Deuce Coupe, ready to be challenged at any corner, and eventually Harrison Ford, as Bob Falfa, shows up to challenge him on a big drag race at the end
and
of the picture.
And Suzanne Summers.
And then we've got Suzanne Summers driving around in this beautiful 56 Ford Thunderbird, and Richard Dreyfuss keeps seeing her, and he wants to try to chase her down and try to find her. She's this dream woman that sort of glides through the film.
Was that her first film?
I think it was, yeah.
That's her break.
Yeah, and I mean, there is this like amazing cast because Cindy Williams is in there, Charlie Martin Smith, Candy Clark, Mackenzie Phillips, Harrison Ford, all of these these actors who would become major film stars in the 70s and 80s.
Neat. What's the clip we got here?
So this is a big conversation, one of the few, although they are working on a car in the scene, one of the few moments where everything kind of sort of stands still and gets a little serious is these two characters played by Richard Dreyfuss and Ron Howard talk about whether or not they are in fact going to go away to college.
From American Graffiti.
Why should I leave home to find a home? You know, why should I leave friends that I love to find new
friends? Wait a minute. I've heard this already. Aren't you the one that told me for 8 weeks that you have to leave the nest sometime?
I realize that.
No realizing. You've been telling me all summer that it's time to stick your head out of the sand and take a look at the big, beautiful world out there somewhere.
But
this thing.
I don't know.
I feel like a midwife.
I may be wrong, Kurt. I may be wrong.
Wrong nothing. You've been telling me for 8 weeks. God damn.
No.
You're just mentally playing with yourself. Just relax, and we'll talk about it at the airport.
Boy, that film brings back memories.
Yeah.
That's, boy, for sure. We're talking great movies and cars with Mitch and Jason. Jason, you're up next with Death Proof.
Yeah, I love Death Proof. Death Proof was part of a double bill that was made called Grindhouse. It was released with another film directed by Robert Rodriguez called Planet Terror. Death Proof is directed by Quentin Tarantino, and the idea came to him. He was at a Volvo dealer, Quentin was, and he was looking for a car, the safest car on the road, because he didn't want to die in a car accident. And a buddy of his said, you know what? You pay any stunt team $10,000 or $15,000, and they can death proof any car. And the phrase death proof stuck with QT. And it just kind of lingered up in his head, and he decided he would make basically a slasher film, but he would make it in his way. So it's sort of fractious and disjointed, but basically he has Kurt Russell, who is, you know, kind of the nicest guy in Hollywood. You know, he plays very genial, yes, everyman types. Everybody loves Kurt Russell. Well, he casts him as a sociopathic stuntman named Stuntman Mike, who drives around in death-proof cars killing people. That's his shtick. And
and he doesn't run them over. I mean, he crashes the car, and that's how he kills people.
At hundreds, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles per hour. And of course, Stuntman Mike is in a death-proof car, these cars that are incredibly reinforced with steel and crash cages and everything else. What he hits, they tend to be sort of factory-fresh Honda Civics, and they don't turn out very well. Mm. What's interesting about this is Tarantino looked at casting for Stuntman Mike, John Travolta, Willem Dafoe, John Malkovich, Mickey Rourke, Mitch's favorite, Ron Perlman, Bruce Willis, and Sylvester Stallone, all of whom had other commitments. They couldn't do it. So he ended up thinking about Kurt Russell, and he said that, for people of my generation, he's a true hero, but now there's this whole audience out there that doesn't know what Kurt Russell can do. And when I open up the newspaper and I see an ad that says Kurt Russell in Dreamer or Kurt Russell in Miracle, I'm not disparaging those movies, but I'm thinking, when is Kurt Russell going to be a badass again?
Mm-hmm.
And he is in this movie. He's great. He has this jacket covered with sponsorship patches like Pennzoil and Icy Hot. It takes place in Austin, Texas, and the movie is knee-deep in hipster Austin cachet. Everybody's, you know, pounding Wild Turkey and PBRs, and, you know, QT's own personal jukebox is the jukebox in the bar, and it's all his song list, and, you know, the girls all wear kind of obscure 70s movie and record label t-shirts. So, you know, if you have a low quotient for hipsters, you probably won't make it all the way through this movie, because a lot of it is basically friends sitting around talking about music, talking about movies, and talking about car movies, because we have two sort of halves. The first half features – it takes place in Austin, and Stuntman Mike offs this girl and her friends, and then it moves to Lebanon, Tennessee, where we have three other – actually four other girls who are led by a real-life stunt woman, a girl named Zoe Bell, who doubled for Uma Thurman in Kill Bill. Tarantino was so impressed, he actually gave her a starring role in this movie. Hmm. And they are out to go and drive a white 1970 Dodge Challenger that is being sold in Tennessee, the same car from Vanishing Point. And stuntman Mike shows up in a tricked-out 69 death-proof Charger and picks a fight with these girls. Well, of course, they're very resourceful, as most women tend to be in Tarantino movies. And they end up turning the tables on him a bit. It is incredibly entertaining and has, yes, I agree with that caller, that emailer. It is an amazing car chase at the end between the Challenger and the Charger. It is as good as anything that's been put in, you know, in a movie. It goes from the interstate to back roads to leaping through fields. It's incredibly great to watch.
How old do you have to be to see this film?
You know, it's got 148 F-bombs in it. You know, it's Tarantino dialogue, it's Tarantino violence. You know, but it's so much fun to see Kurt Russell go full badass, because he's so dark and he has this mammoth scar down one side of his face, like a huge pirate dueling scar, and he's great. He's this genial, horrible, evil person, but he's great.
What's the clip?
This clip is actually he is about to take home his first victim. He's going to give her a ride home from a bar in his 71 Chevy Nova, which is one of the main cars. It has a huge skull and crossbones painted on the hood, and he's telling her all about how to death proof a car.
From Death Proof.
Wow, that's scary.
Yeah, well, I wanted it to be impressive. Scary tends to impress.
Is it safe?
No, it's better than safe. It's death-proof.
How do you make a car death-proof?
Well, that's what stuntmen do. You've seen a movie where a car gets into some smash-up there ain't no way in hell anybody's walking away from.
Yeah.
Well, how do you think they accomplish that?
CGI?
Well, unfortunately, Pam, nowadays, more often than not, you're right. But back in the all-or-nothing days, Vanishing Point days, the Dirty Mary Crazy Larry days, White Lion fever days. Real cars smashing into real cars. Real dumb people driving them. So, give the stunt team the car you want to smash up, take her and reinforce everywhere, and voila. You got yourself a death-proof automobile.
That makes sense. I just didn't know you could make a car death-proof.
Hell, I can drive this baby into a brick wall doing 125 miles an hour. Just for the experience.
He's so great. He's really great in it.
I hold in my hand the name of today's last film, Mitch Bryan, The Driver.
The Driver, which is probably the spiritual godfather of Drive. 1978, Walter Hill made this picture. He had just come off making a bare knuckles boxing movie with Charles Bronson called Hard Times, which is a terrific film.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned his attention to the streets of Los Angeles and to an existential story of a getaway driver pursued by a cop. And in fact, in this movie, nobody has any names. The driver is the driver. The detective is the detective. The player is the player. And so Bruce Dern plays this cop who is pursuing Ryan O'Neill, the getaway driver. And it's an extraordinary film. It has these amazing set pieces. One of the most interesting ones features this horrifying orange 1969 Mercedes. And the driver is showing these guys how good he is. And what he does is he gets into the car and he proceeds to smash the car to pieces in an inside parking lot, and just takes the car apart one piece at a time. And since it's such an ugly car, it's just fine to watch him just demolish this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The dialogue in the movie is very sparse. There's, as in so many of Walter Hill's movies, there's a certain cowboy Western quality to it. You know, it's kind of a modern Western. It's very male. It's very driven by these two macho guys, the cop who's never lost a, you know, who's been able to catch every cowboy he wants to catch, and the driver who's never been caught. And it's mm-hmm. a duel between these two guys all through the film.
What's the clip we get?
So here's Bruce Dern as the detective schooling one of his other detectives on the way he should be living his life as a cop.
From The Driver.
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to help you be a better cop. You know how? You know what you do first thing every morning? Read the sports page. You know why? Best part of the newspaper. Winners, losers, how it happened, score, Now, we've got a much better game than the one they give the players. They don't retire us after 10 years.
Just one thing. You got to be a player. A real player. Not just filling out a position.
I guess you figure you're a winner.
That's it. And you're a loser. But I think you'd like to be a winner.
Again, that's from The Driver.
That's Kraske 101, that pep talk.
There you go. Mitch and Jason, thanks so much, guys. And sorry we couldn't get to all our callers today. Mike from Independence was going to recommend Gone in 60 Seconds. Mm-hmm. Ray from North Kansas City to Live and Die in L.A. Danny from Raytown was recommending The Italian Job. I thought it was great to see Cameron Diaz behind the wheel, plus Mini Coopers, plus the tunnels. And Richard writes us that in The French Connection, Gene Hackman's character is constantly on the edge of disaster. And again, our DVD gurus have their own Facebook page. Check it out on Facebook. If you want to actually go out and see a movie in a real theater, you can check out our three favorites, three to see showing in area theaters this weekend at kcur.org. Monday in the program, we're talking jobs, the search, resumes, and background checks. We had help today from Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Kim Noble, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.